the bomb and the blast was the destruction of the health system, so that those who were wounded die of their wound or become permanently disabled from previously reconstructible injury. And the second killing machine was the infectious diseases, and continues to be. And we can see the figures are horrendous. And this is, you create that killing machine by destroying the water and sewage treatment system, by destroying 60 to 70% of people's homes and forcing them into schools that had been previously designed for 1,000 students and now house over 10 to 15,000 family members. And so we see the numbers of 8,000 hepatitis A cases, hundreds of thousands of respiratory and diarrheal diseases. And that is an intentional mechanism by which Israel wanted to kill. And then the third killing machine, which we are witnessing, and which basically brought Israel into its current impasse with its accomplices, is starvation as one of the killing machines of the genocidal project. Israel had decided that one of the fastest ways to kill people is to starve them, and set about creating the conditions for a famine, which started to take root and continues to take root. And what we see in terms of the number of children dying of this famine is really very, it literally is the tip of the iceberg, because the rest of those who are affected by malnutrition will die as a result of the effects of the malnutrition, which we know are an increase in non-communicable diseases as they get older. It is becoming immunocompromised and therefore more likely to get and succumb to infectious diseases. And it is cognitive impairment in children affected by malnutrition. And so these killing machines, the last two of them, Israel intends to maintain during the ceasefire. And that's what we need to defeat during the ceasefire. The other things that we need to be very aware of and we need to be very cognizant of is the humanitarian, and this is a tricky one for the tongue, the humanitarization of the genocide. We have been seeing the conclusion of this insidious Western humanitarianism that in the 1990s became an excuse for imperialism, and now we are being told it can coexist with genocide and therefore humanitarianize genocide, so that as long as you're dropping the food parcels and you're sending in the medical teams and there's a pier where you can send some ships, then it's okay to continue the genocide as long as there are enough NGOs and charities on the ground to provide that humanitarian cover. Again, our resistance to the totality of genocide is to talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow, our children will laugh in Palestine. But we need to ensure that there are schools for them to go to. There are hospitals for them to be treated in. There are homes for them to live in. And most importantly, that there is a free Palestine in their lifetime to dream about. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What you just heard were the remarks of Dr. Carmen Abulsi and Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, delivered at the World Academic Forum for Palestine genocide in Gaza, held at the University of Houston on April 6th and 7th, 2024. One of the organizers for that forum is also Dr. Chandni Desai, who is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. She also spoke at that forum. Let's listen in.
45,000 missiles, giant bombs, dumb bombs, bunker-busting bombs, white phosphorus, smart bombs, weighing 65,000 tons, more than the weight and power of three nuclear bombs, indiscriminately dropped over the densely populated areas in Gaza within the first 100 days of Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinian people. Burning through flesh, causing severe burns, injuries, disabilities for those that survived. Nine internationally banned bombs and missiles were and continue to be used for mass killings. 31,000 martyrs and counting, and the total destruction of essential infrastructure, obliterating hospitals, schools, universities, bakeries, health clinics, residential areas, homes, religious sites, cultural heritage, roads, agricultural sites, and other aspects of infrastructure. Threats of annihilating Palestinian existence and wiping a people off the map, genocidal intent, has been heard, witnessed, well documented, and presented, particularly before the International Court of Justice by South Africa. In the first 100 days of Israel's genocide, every university in Gaza was bombed and destroyed, alongside libraries, archives, publishing houses, cultural centers, activity halls, museums, bookstores, cemeteries, monuments, and archival materials that date over 150 years. History turned to rubble and dust. 386 school buildings, or 78% of all schools in Gaza, have sustained damage, with 25 schools fully damaged. Many schools and universities before their destruction were transformed into military barracks or bases where Israeli occupation forces engaged in torture and the execution of Palestinians that they had kidnapped or were housing in particular schools. Taking pride in their barbaric war crimes, Israeli occupation forces blow up universities and schools on live stream and post videos on social media outlining the destruction they've caused. Al-Isra was one where we saw the detonation with 315 mines on live stream. Over 5,000 students, 240 teachers, and 100 academics have been killed. This is a conservative estimate, and many were deliberately targeted and assassinated, such as Soufiane Taye, the president of Islamic University of Gaza and one of Gaza's top scientists, but also the world's top scientist, and the beloved English professor Rifat Al-Arir, similar to the ways in which Palestinian intellectuals and cultural figures have been historically targeted and assassinated. And I just mentioned two, but the list is massive. Almost 90,000 Palestinian university students cannot attend a university anymore in Gaza because they simply do not exist. And 620,000 students are out of school. Israel is committing scholasticide. It is a colonial attempt to annihilate Palestinian futures and existence, and this also applies to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Scholasticide was coined by the Oxford professor Carmen Ebolsi during the 2009 Israeli assault on Gaza to describe the systematic destruction of Palestinian education by Israel, and she contextualized it within the context of Israel's decades-long settler colonization, apartheid, and occupation of Palestine. Following Israeli airstrikes on Al-Azhar University and the Islamic University in November 2023, building on this conceptualization, Abdel Razak Takriti and I worked to broaden the definition to encapsulate a far more broader definition because of the unprecedented scale of destruction and killing that we saw during this war and the annihilation of Palestinian education, which is distinct from previous Israeli invasions of Gaza. Abid Tikriti notes, and I quote him, Israel's colonial policy in Gaza has now shifted from a focus on systematic destruction to total annihilation of education, end quote. Scholasticide comprises acts that entail systematic destruction in whole or in part of the educational life of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Scholasticide is a central pillar of genocide, particularly this genocide. If we go back to the original definition of genocide that was penned by Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, he observed that genocide is a composite of different acts of persecution or destruction, ranging from physical elimination to the forced disintegration of a people's political and social institutions, culture, language, national sentiments, and religion. And the genocide definition doesn't actually encapsulate this. So given that the Palestinian education system and knowledge systems are social, political, and cultural institutions, under the Lemkinian definition, their denial of the right to exist as a people and the subsequent attempt to annihilate them through various modes of elimination makes this a structural genocide, what scholars of settler colonial studies would call a structural genocide. For Lemkin, genocide is a process, not an act. And the way I think about it, scholasticide is not an event. Scholasticide is a feature of Israeli colonialism. As the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese, recently penned in her report, Anatomy of Genocide, she suggests, I quote, Israel's genocide on the Palestinians in Gaza is an escalatory stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure. For over seven decades, this process has suffocated the Palestinian people as a group, demographically, culturally, economically, and politically, seeking to displace it and expropriate and control its land and resources, end quote. The massive destruction and erasure of Palestinian educational life, history, and culture is a state-organized practice. The state-organized practice of a colonial apartheid state. This systematic destruction is at the core of the settler colonial logic of elimination. This logic drives a settler population and settler populations to replace indigenous peoples in their aim to establish a new society on the land that they're trying to take. This logic was exercised during the 1948 Nakba. Thousands of Palestinian books, manuscripts, libraries, archives, photographs, cultural artifacts, and cultural property were looted, destroyed, or damaged by Zionist militias. In 1948, Palestinian schools were destroyed or damaged, or later appropriated for use by the new Israeli state in many ways. Scholasticide is part of the colonial continuity of attacking, destroying, and erasing a people's educational life, knowledge systems, plundering material culture and cultural heritage, and most importantly, erasure. The assault on Palestinian educational and cultural institutions did not begin in response to the October 7th Al-Aqsa operation. Israel has a long record of targeted attacks on Palestinian institutions that produce knowledge and culture, and also engages in the theft and destruction of Palestinian materials, knowledge, books, archives, libraries, art, but also the targeting and the killing of Palestinian intellectuals and cultural producers. Palestinians have endured several periods of intense attacks on their cultural and educational life. This includes the 1967 war, Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon, during which a number of Palestinian liberation organizations, institutions that produce knowledge were destroyed, that Ilan Pape referenced, and the first and second intifadas. Following Israel's destruction of the Palestine Research Center in Lebanon in 1982, the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish said, I quote, he who steals land does not surprise us by stealing a library. He who kills thousands of innocent civilians does not surprise us by killing paintings, end quote. The colonial theft continues unabashed. During the bombing of, Al Isra University in January 2024, Israel also targeted the National Museum. Licensed by the Ministry of Antiquities, the museum housed over 3,000 rare artifacts, which were looted. According to the Arab Regional Group at the International Council of Monuments and Sites, more than 200 of the 325 registered sites in Gaza considered of national or global historic, archaeological, natural, religious, and humanitarian importance have been destroyed or severely damaged by the Israeli military. And the Archivists and Librarians for Palestine Collective have documented extensively the destruction of cultural heritage during this genocidal war. And this is why we have to think about the importance of Palestinian institutions. Palestinian institutions are so important and necessary because it is within those institutions that collective life is imagined, organized, and created. When possible, anti-colonial collective life is imagined, organized, and created. For colonized peoples, education, whether in the form of formal or informal schooling or knowledge transmission, is essential for survival. Half a century before the famous Brazilian educator Paulo Freire wrote Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the Palestinian educator Khalil Sakakini believed that education could be used for rebellion and emancipation against colonial powers. During the British Mandate of Palestine, he was convinced that he and the educational system were obliged to carry out a national project, a national political project, with a great potential to bring about far-reaching social change. Sakakini outlined the significance of education as rooted in the Palestinian anti-colonial struggle against the British mandate and Zionist forces. And as Ilan Pape just mentioned, the proposal for Palestinian universities were refused by the mandate. After 1948, part of Palestine's material base was lost during the Nakba. As such, Palestinian society invested immensely in education as a source, a significant source of human capital, particularly for the refugees. As Carmen Abulsi just reminded us a few minutes ago, education was one of the most important aspects for the refugee people. The Palestinian people have the highest literacy rate in the Arab world. They have the highest number of PhD graduates per capita worldwide. Against colonial erasure and loss, education has had profound political significance for the Palestinian people. For colonized societies, education rooted in anti-colonial struggle opens up possibilities for documenting, knowing, and analyzing one's history, preserving national identity, building a national movement, resisting colonial imperialist violence, and also connecting with other struggles. For the Palestinian Liberation Organization, education was thus essential, and youth, particularly refugees, were supported through the establishment of educational institutions, specifically in the refugee camps. Curriculum development took place, the dissemination of children's books produced by publishing houses such as Dar al-Fateh al-Arabi also was one mechanism of support. Scholarships, grants, and other financial assistance was provided to Palestinian students, including political and financial assistance to the General Union of Palestinian Students. When Palestinian universities were established in the 1970s in the West Bank and Gaza, they took upon themselves the important role of construction of a Palestinian national identity against settler colonialism. Universities became spaces that facilitated the political evolution of the Palestinian national movement and collective life. During the four-year closure of Palestinian schools during the First Intifada, popular education was established and teaching and learning continued. They continued through mass support and popular initiatives. The Israeli state knew the importance of education for the colonized, and Ilan, I think, mentioned a bit of that. From the outset, they perceived Palestinian universities as a hotbed of nationalism and anti-colonial struggle. In the post-Oslo period, in the absence of a unified Palestinian liberation movement, Palestinian universities, to some degree, at moments fill the gaps, and part of it is the student activism that Samia gestured to. For this reason, Israel has issued hundreds of military orders targeting Palestinian universities and their faculty and students who have been targets of direct and structural Israeli violence, including incarceration, which again Samia talked about, which also constitute features of scholasticide. For a people under a siege, a 16-year siege, universities have been creative, innovative hubs for social, political, and economic development. And I really learned about the medical sector through one of my friends, Tariq Lubani, a couple of months ago, and the kind of innovative work that happens in hospitals to create ways to serve a people. Despite many Israeli invasions prior to the Gaza genocide, the people of Gaza have always remained steadfast and have rebuilt after numerous wars. The targeted killing of the educated class is intended to make it difficult for Palestinians to restore the political and socioeconomic conditions needed to survive and rebuild Gaza, particularly as it has been made uninhabitable during this genocide, and also as Israel tries to put its plan of ethnic cleansing through the genocide in process. Everything right now feels urgent. The political priorities at this time have to be clear. Working collectively to end this genocide is number one. Ending the siege as part of ending that genocide is central. And because we're scholars, ending the scholasticide is important because it is a feature of genocide. Despite this whole-scale destruction of Gaza's education system, most academic institutions around the world have remained silent about Israel's scholasticide. It is incredibly shameful that university administrators, deans, and even our colleagues have been quiet about this destruction and annihilation. What is needed is principled anti-colonial international solidarity from this part of the world, which entails supporting Palestinian institutions in Gaza first and foremost, and heeds the asks of our colleagues in Gaza, which Amani has given us many things to think about, specifically institutional partnerships that also break the siege, despite knowing how difficult this would be in Western institutions, given the funding of the pro-Israel lobby. Nevertheless, those that want to support higher education in Palestine, specifically Gaza, need to be mindful that one's own approaches or desire to help does not contribute to erasure, as the Israeli state has already attempted to do so. There are numerous initiatives popping up that reproduce certain colonial and racial logics that actually don't align with what our colleagues in Gaza need. And it's imperative to really think about why it is that you want to do what you want to do if it's not grounded in what is being asked for. Solidarity with Gaza's institutions of higher education needs to be enacted on principles that do not undermine and delegitimize those existing institutions, because these institutions are the backbone in a colonial society. Despite the buildings being destroyed and many killed, they are also academics who have survived and will endure this genocide. Principled anti-colonial solidarity resists individualism and savior mentalities. Rather, it requires listening to those that are most impacted by this genocide, that have been forcefully displaced, like my colleagues, that have lost their homes and their livelihoods, they've lost their universities, and are actually uncertain about what the future holds. They say, will we even return? Even if the genocide ends, it will take years to rebuild Gaza's educational sector, which has experienced a state of collapse. Rebuilding and returning to the previous fragile state requires significant effort and international resources at the local, regional, and international levels. There must be a strong commitment to advocacy to highlight the importance of education and improve its infrastructure and support for faculty and students. As Amani stated, there is a risk of a brain drain and de-development. Principled international solidarity is thinking of ways to support our colleagues that want to ensure that education of their students continue even with schools and university closures. And we have history lessons to look to, like the First Intifada. We also need to be mindful of the role of Israeli institutions, particularly universities, in their complicity in the genocide and scholasticide, as Israeli universities are architects that developed the military strategies, technologies, weaponry for the annihilation of the Palestinian people. And our institutions, financial alliances and allegiances and partnerships with Israeli universities are complicit in genocide. The ICJ in its historic ruling on 26 January 2024 determined that Israel is plausibly committing genocide and issued provisional measures for Israel to immediately stop its genocidal acts under Article 2 of the Genocide Convention. We must act as faculty and students to ensure that our institutions uphold their ethical obligations under international law. The Scholasticide Toolkit developed by Scholars Against the War on Palestine is an important resource that is being used globally to develop letters on scholasticide to university administrators, used to mobilize motions for faculty associations and unions, scholasticide vigils that are being held to commemorate our fallen comrades and colleagues and students, and events to discuss the destruction of Palestinian universities and institutions and the complicity of Israeli universities in that destruction. As part of a broader campaign, scholasticide is an important aspect of genocide, and that can be also used in organizing spaces to bring light to not only what is happening in Gaza, but eventually to really thinking about moving forward when it comes to BDS initiatives that many people might be involved in. Posing ethical and moral questions about what Israel is doing is imperative now more than ever, as a people are being slaughtered for all of us to see on a daily. In the face of an Israeli US-backed genocide, we have to find ways to educate, imagine, organize, mobilize, and support our Palestinian colleagues, Palestinian students, Palestinian institutions, guided by principles of anti-colonialism. Let's work collectively here and across the country to ensure that our colleagues' deaths do not go in vain, but beyond the country, let's collectively work globally in a movement to ensure that our colleagues' deaths do not go in vain. Thank you.
That was Dr. Chandni Desai, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto and one of the organizers at the World Academic Forum for Palestine, Genocide in Gaza, speaking at that forum. It was held at the University of Houston on April 6th and 7th, 2024, organized by Scholars Against the War in Palestine. I plan on airing more remarks delivered at that historic forum during future episodes of Arab Voices. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Radio Laura, eine kleine Stimme gegen das Böse.
Will anyone listen? I wish I could just wail over their bodies. I wish I could just run barefoot in every refugee camp and hold every child, cover their ears so they wouldn't have to hear the sound of bombing for the rest of their life the way that I do. I wish I could just wail over their bodies. Run barefoot in every refugee camp and hold every child, cover their ears so they wouldn't have to hear the sound of bombing for the rest of their life the way that I do. 'Cause let me just tell you, there's no soundbite. No matter how good my English gets, no soundbite. No matter how well I practice, no soundbite, no soundbite, no soundbite, no soundbite will bring them back to life, and no soundbite will fix this. We teach life, sir. We teach life, sir. We Palestinians wake up every morning to teach the rest of the world life, sir.
Why are we in this situation that brings us down? Can't you see we are losing patience? We are losing patience with oppression now. The people will rise, 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 the people will rise. We have come to raise our voices, to raise our voices for the broken down. You and me, we will stand stand together, we will stand together on common ground. The people will rise, the people will rise, the people will rise, the people will rise.